Good morning. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking to Ann Littlewood. Ann, welcome to KABU.
Thank you very much, Ed. It's great to be here.
Now, this is your second book about Iris Oakley, who was a zookeeper at the fictional, what's the name of the zoo in Vancouver?
Well, it's the Finley Memorial Zoo. It's named after the Oregon great Oregon conservationist, William Finley.
Okay. The title of your book is Did Not Survive, and it's published by Poison Pen Press. This is in the stores now, eh?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
Before we get started, because I don't want to forget this, if you have any events that are coming up that people might be interested in going to, why don't you use this time to tell us about them?
Well, there's a fun event coming up this weekend in Vancouver, Washington, just across the river for you Portland residents. It is Art in the Heart, which is a street fair in downtown Vancouver. And I'll be there Friday evening and most of Saturday. After that, my next local event will be September 3rd at the downtown Borders at 7 o'clock, right across the street from the Rack. So I'd be happy to see you there.
Okay. This is the second book featuring Iris Oakley, who's a zookeeper. What went on in the first book? Because when we meet Iris, she is pregnant and a widow, and she's a young woman. So tell us what went on in the first book.
Well, bad things happened to Iris. Her marriage broke up, and her husband decided that he wanted to reconcile and promised to quit drinking. Next thing she knows, he's dead drunk and just plain dead in the lion enclosure. So Nightkill has to do with Iris struggling through her grief and anger and feeling of betrayal to finally realize she has to figure out what really happened to her husband. Now in Did Not Survive, we find her 6 months later, and she's got a baby bump going and is trying to figure out how to organize her life to be a single mother and with a full-time job. No easy task for anyone who's done that knows.
When the book opens, there's a very well. Iris is at the zoo early in the morning because she's working with birds. Generally, that's right. Yes,
she's a bird keeper, yeah. But she used to be a feline keeper, and she still has strong ties emotionally to the big cats.
The big cats, yeah. But she sees something in the elephant enclosure that's most distressing. What does she see?
She hears a ruckus in the elephant barn. It's at dawn. Nobody's around. Nobody should be around. And she goes on over there and finds an old elephant, Damery, rampaging around her stall with a person lying face down in the straw with blood on him. And this immediately raises several questions. She recognizes the person. It's her boss, the foreman. What on earth was he doing there at dawn? Why on earth would he go in with an elephant alone? And why would this reliable old gal, Damery, the elephant, attack him? They were, you know, the foreman and the elephant knew each other well and had a very amiable relationship. So this kind of kicks off the mystery, although Iris is a bird keeper. She's not an elephant expert. And she doesn't really see it as her problem to figure this out. But she gets sucked into it.
Mm-hmm. As is always the case with amateur detectives, they always find some way to get sucked into it.
That's right.
Her relationship with the penguins is very funny in this book. I really enjoy she has to first she has to set up the feed, which includes, among other things, sticking vitamin pills in the gills of tiny little fish and then feeding these tiny little fish to the penguins.
Well, you can't just hand them the pills with their coffee.
That's right. Now, you have experience as a zookeeper.
Oh, yes. I worked at it's now called the Oregon Zoo, for 12 years. I was a nursery keeper, so we pretty much got everything, and I have hand-reared a penguin or two. And, of course, I was trained on all the areas. So I've worked with a wide variety of animals. It was good to get back to that world, at least in my head.
At least in your head. One of the characteristics of the people in this book, the zookeepers, the zoo personnel, is their intimate relationship with the animals. I mean, they're in with them every day in a physical, sometimes hands-on way. But there develops between them a rapport is too mild a word for this, is a communication that goes on between the zookeepers and their animals, yes?
Yes, I would say so. You know, the animals look, say, to go back to penguins, say a flock of penguins, they all look identical to, you know, to a zoo visitor, unless some of them are molting funny or young or something like that. But the keepers quickly learn individuals, and they have different personalities. And some of them are charming and some of them aren't. And it's just like any other group of people or pets or whatever, although that's pets is probably the wrong word. So and then the animals have their preferences and they'll be very cooperative with one keeper and kind of ornery with another one for no particular reason.
So we have this terrible incident wherein, of course, the first suspect has to be Damry the elephant.
That is correct.
Yes.
It's assumed by all except the head elephant keeper that what else could explain this situation?
Mm-hmm.
But he's staunch in his defense of her. Because, and from Iris's perspective, that's because he didn't see it.
Yeah. But the people tend to know the animals that they take care of. And it seems that this is out of character or presumed to be out of character for them.
This is definitely out of character. But people also like the animals they work with and they want to defend them. So, you know, there is an emotional component here where you could question that Sam, the elephant keeper, might not be the best judge, in a sense, even though he's very skilled and knows her very well. But he does have an emotional attachment to her.
He's biased.
Yeah. In a good way.
Yeah. The zoo itself is under some kind of strain. It's not just Iris. It's under strain being pregnant and a widow. And there are changes going on at the zoo, changes in personnel. Certainly, the death of a manager is going to be a problem when everybody liked the manager. It wasn't like, oh, too bad. You know, they actually liked Kevin Wallace. What's going on at the zoo? What's happening there that's causing internal agita along with this unfortunate death?
Well, Findlay Memorial Zoo is a small zoo. It's been poor, and it hasn't had opportunities to be really well run. I mean, you take a zoo that is fairly well funded and fairly well run, like the Oregon Zoo, I should say better than fairly. It's very well run. And the opportunities for disaster just aren't as great. So I had to make up my own zoo where things could go badly wrong. But they've passed a bond measure, so they're building new exhibits, but it will come as no surprise that the money's run out before they can get all the plans in place. The money ran out for the elephant exhibit is the fear. In addition, the zoo's being picketed. Zoos, especially zoos with elephants, get a fair amount of grief from animal welfare activists. And since so much of the book is about elephants, that's an important thread in the real life zoo world. And I wanted to work that in and try to present a balanced picture about how that plays out from the zoo perspective without making the activists into the villains or the bad guys. They're suspects, but everybody's a suspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a guy named Thor who Thorson is his last name, but Thor is his nickname. And he's particularly aggressive, I guess, really is the right word, about caring for the elephants. And he wants them to have a vast space to wander in, like they have in Africa or India.
Yes, and the zoo people, I think, would counter that it's not the quantity of space that counts, it's the quality. That yes, there needs to be a certain minimum of space for the animals to get enough exercise and to provide the kind of diversity that would interest them. I mean, you could have a huge, you know, paved parking lot. That wouldn't do an elephant any good. You know, they're going to want boulders and a pool and maybe a hill and something like a bush that they can wreck and feeding opportunities. You know, elephants in the wild move around a lot because they have to. They have to find food and water and mates and to escape from danger, which is generally humans. So I think that there needs to be a little bit of more of a nuanced approach to this idea of vast spaces.
In the wild, elephants aren't afraid of much. There's not much that can handle an elephant in the wild, except human beings.
That pretty much is correct. They have to watch out with the calves, mm-hmm. With the babies. But once they're full grown, it's us. Mm-hmm. We're the danger.
Yeah. The one time I was in Africa, we had to stop because 300 elephants were crossing the road, and they took their own time to do it. And we were not bored for 1 second watching 300 elephants cross the road.
So, wow, I wish I'd been there.
I wish I could go again. Let's talk about some of the people at the zoo. Now, there is a family there, I guess, for want of a better term. These are the people, if you have a small office, a small organization you work with, people kind of have an intimate bond in this thing. And you like some people and you don't like some people, but everybody's character and personality is part of the mix. There's a guy named Denny that I liked a lot.
I love Denny.
Yeah, tell us about Denny.
I love Denny. Oh, I've got a whole backstory for Denny. Someday that'll come out. Basically, there's a throwaway line in the book, but it's true. He was raised in a yurt by Wiccans. And and Denny has a unique approach to problem solving, which is just a brainstorm the most. And he's a little bit of a conspiracy theorist.
A little bit?
Yeah.
Everything is a conspiracy, yes.
Yeah. On the other hand, he has a pretty cheerful attitude toward life. He's not doer and suspicious toward people. He just freewheels, drives Iris nuts. But she has to put up with him because, for one thing, he's dating her best friend, which she disapproves of, but she doesn't get to vote. So Denny's always right somewhere along the line, but Denny's got so much going on, it's hard to pick out what's right.
Yeah, he was a lot of fun. I liked him. There's also Calvin. Calvin becomes a suspect in this case, this murder of Kevin Wallace. If I'm jumping on the plot a little too heavily here, you can tell me, but tell us something about Calvin.
Well, just as Denny represented all the hippies I knew, he's an amalgam of the hippies I knew in my year on a commune. Calvin, for me, represents the older keepers for when I first started. And they were all male, with one exception, because there weren't women at the zoo then. And these guys, some of them were quirky in ways that were good and some in ways that weren't so good, but they were all really decent to me. And Calvin represents that kind of solid workman attitude toward his job. He's a guy that you can trust. And he's a guy very devoted to his family, and that's where the conflict comes in.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Anne Littlewood. She's the author of Did Not Survive, published by Poison Pen Press. You know, I forgot to write down the name of the young woman who, with all the jewelry.
Kayla.
Kayla, that's yes. It, yeah. I was going to say Kayla, but I figured that can't be right. It is,
yeah.
Kayla. Yeah, Kayla's an interesting person. What's Kayla do?
She is the vet tech, and her job is diets and administering medications. And she brings a lot of life into the zoo. The zoo's kind of stressed out by losing the foreman and all the other things going on. And she's a very lively, pretty, energetic, fun person to have around. She's a lot of fun. And she brings that element of play into their lives, and especially into Iris's life. Iris is literally kind of burdened, what with her pregnancy and psychologically with some of her worries.
Now, there's a place they hang out, and they go to a bar to hang out, and before Iris was pregnant, she would have a few beers with everybody, but they sit around and drink, and a lot of what goes on in the case comes out in these, what you've chosen to do is give us information during these little bar sessions, because people's personalities come out, this is where the Thor comes into the issue here. I thought that was a fairly good idea to create a social setting wherein information gets exchanged.
Well, it wasn't hard because the zookeepers used to hang out at the Goose Hollow Inn.
Oh, of all places.
Yeah, yeah. And there would be, you know, Bud and Sigrid, I think was his wife, you know, at another booth over. And then sometimes Audubon once held a wolf howling contest and we called it the Goose. So I just transplanted the Goose to Vancouver and changed it around a little. And tried to bring back those memories of good times there.
Yeah, I want to see the. You're a lifelong environmentalist and a volunteer with the Audubon Society, so you're into the birds, eh?
I got started with Audubon actually when I was at the zoo. Al Miller, rest his soul, got me sucked into a committee on wildlife rehabilitation at Audubon, and it just sort of stuck. And I've been there, been volunteering with them for various projects ever since. It's a wonderful organization. It's a gift to Portland.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend, if you aren't familiar with it, get yourself up there. and find out about all the things Audubon does.
Well, as a low-level birder, I can recognize all the telltale signs of someone who's into looking at birds in this book. So,
yes, well, I'm not an expert, and Iris isn't an expert either, but she notices.
So this leads to the question, there's any number of ways you could write novels that would be that would include all of your feelings about animals and zoos and things like that. Why mysteries? Why murder and mayhem in these books?
Well, I've always read mysteries. It's, you know, I was sort of weaned on Earl Stanley Garner and Nero Wolfe.
Oh, classic stuff.
You bet. When I was a kid, and everybody reads mysteries, right? I read mysteries. And one of the things I like about mysteries is that they kind of have rules about how things should go. And that was a comfort to me in writing my first one, writing Nightkill. And, you know, you don't have to follow the rules, but it's nice to know kind of what the expected structure is. I had a career in technical writing, so I wrote for a living for 20 years. Fiction is very different. You know, it's like having six balls in the air at once. So mysteries seemed like a good fit for me. I'd had the concept even when I was back at the zoo, and no regrets. I did it from a first-person point of view because I wanted to write it from the lens of a person who had kind of a limited, peripheral vision, you might say. She sees things through kind of a biological, natural history lens. I wanted to work with that.
Well, it's a really honest way to write a mystery because your reader finds out what your protagonist finds out when your protagonist finds out about it. And if you're rigorous and honest about it, then sometimes the reader will pick up clues before the protagonist does. So.
You got that right. And in both my mysteries, one of the things to keep an eye on is the animal behavior. In both mysteries, that provides Iris, when she finally figures it out, with an important clue.
There's a policeman named Quintana, and he's involved in this case because the cops have to be involved in a murder.
Well, I have to tell you one thing about Quintana first.
Okay.
His is the only last name that isn't the name of a famous biologist or scientist, but I just loved the rhythm of Detective Quintana, so I made an exception in his case.
If we find a biologist named Quintana, you can...
Then I'm good. Then I'm good.
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
He's run into Iris before.
This is the first time they worked together.
I haven't read the first book. But like all cops, he treats people who are investigating the case on their own as a pain in the neck. And figures that they're somehow going to corrupt the investigation or do something that the cops won't like to have happen. This is a classic setup for an amateur detective. Yes.
Yes, it is. And you know, he's kind of right. He's kind of right. Iris is kind of floundering around. Keep in mind that Iris is not always a reliable narrator. You know, I expect the reader to evaluate people based on what they say and do as well as what Iris thinks of them. He's a pretty good guy, actually. He's mm-hmm. pretty tolerant.
Well, you know, the unreliable narrator is a classic, another classic device that writers of all types use. But once you begin to trust the character, and of course you begin to trust Iris almost implicitly, right in the, you know, by chapter two, then the unreliability after a while, you don't see it because, and I suppose that's...
She never trusts Thor, but what does Thor ever do that isn't pretty honest and straightforward?
Yeah, but, you know, you don't know that till, you know, later on. So,
oh, dear. All
yeah.
right. Well, except for the big twist at the end, of course.
Another thing, zoo security. This is something I think most people don't think about. This Finley Memorial Zoo has problems. There are ways to get into the zoo that are not by the front gate, and their security system is somewhat lacking, which, of course, leads to complications in the mystery.
Yeah, zoos really do struggle with this. Things are a lot tighter than they were in my day. I mean, there were times when I would walk into the zoo at like 6 in the morning. I had keys, of course, but I would go into an animal area, load up an animal, and carry it out and drive away with it, which I was supposed to do, but nobody ever saw me. Mm-hmm. You know, I could have been anybody. So zoos have perimeter fences and There's always issues. There's always concerns about, you know, vandals. And again, like I say, Findlay Zoo is a little underfunded, a little old-fashioned, and that's something that it's going to have to work on.
So you have a murder at the zoo. You have nobody really knows who committed the murder. Suspicions shift from person to person. One group suspects somebody, another group suspects another person, and of course, Denny suspects everybody. And then, on top of everything else, animals start disappearing.
Yes, yes, and it's everyone keeps telling Iris that it's unrelated, that that she's trying to put too many things together. But let's not go too far with that, Ed.
Yes, I understand.
I worked hard on those plot twists.
Well, tell us a little about Raja. You got to tell us a little about Raja.
Oh, Raja is a dear. Actually, on my website, if you look around, there's an interview with Raja. Raja's an aging tiger. He's been at the zoo since he was a cub. And there's an interview with his whole life story and his perspective on it. And, you know, he's a beautiful animal. Tigers are very charismatic. And, you know, love is not too strong a word, I think, to apply to the way people who know him feel about Raja. But he's an old, sick animal, and, you know, nothing lives forever. And that's about, I think, as far as
you want to take
I'll go with, yeah, with the plot line on Raja.
There's also cloud leopards. I'd never heard of a cloud leopard. And there's a birth at the zoo of a cloud leopard. This is very unusual, yes?
Yeah, clouded leopards are they're incredibly beautiful. They are in the big cat group. They're actually the cat most closely related to saber-tooth cats. Yeah, they're the closest link, and they do have long teeth because they live up in the canopy in Asia and Thailand and so on, and catch birds. Well, birds are full of feathers, so you kind of need long teeth to get through all that. At least that's the theory.
They must be small and lithe then.
Yeah, they're more like a bobcat size and very agile with these gorgeous pelts. I mean, they are beautiful, beautiful cats. And they tend to be very much on the nervous side. They're a hard cat to manage.
Do we have clouded leopards at the Oregon Zoo? No.
No, they had them up at Point Defiance Zoo, but I'm not sure they're still there.
Mm-hmm. The notation for a birth at the zoo I found very interesting. Tell us about that notation.
Well, the title of the book, Did Not Survive, comes from a zoo phrase. It's a
DNS.
DNS, yeah. Zoos pay attention and report their births and hatchings. Well, let's say there's a birth of, say, six meerkats. The keepers get a look at them, and then they can record the birth as, let's say, 3/2/1 DNS. So the 3 would be the males, the 2 would be the females, and the 1 DNS would be 1 did not survive.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of minutes left. Why don't you tell us what you're working on now? Is there going to be another Iris Oakley book, or are you looking for a standalone maybe?
Well, I'm kind of torn. There's 2 directions available to me at this point, 2 ideas that I have. One would be kind of a thriller plot involving a baby orangutan. You familiar with the phrase, a MacGuffin?
Yes.
Yes, that's
the Hitchcock films.
Yes, that's the
thing that gets the plot rolling.
Yeah, the desirable object that everyone seeks. So that is one plot that I've kind of worked out, and I'm waiting to hear from my poison pen editor about that. And the other possibility pulls together some ideas about animal hoarders and dysfunctional families and drugs in rural areas.
Got a lot of animal hoarders in Oregon, don't we?
And ties that into, instead of hoarding dogs and cats, hoarding parrots and snakes so that the zoo gets involved.
Orangutans, I just happen to be fascinated with primates, and orangutan in the language means man of the forest. And, you know, people talk about how close we are to chimps and how close we are to gorillas and all this stuff and bonobos. But if you look in the eyes of an orangutan, you see almost a human intelligence peering back at you.
Indeed you do. Indeed you do. And folks, you should get up to the zoo and take a look at the Red Ape Reserve new exhibit they're building. It's really wonderful. They're you know, Ingie, our older female, and the other orangs are going to be really delighted with it. How much time do we have?
I don't know. 2 minutes, maybe? Three
I can
minutes?
Tell you a story.
Sure.
It's apocryphal. It's not a Zeus. But the story is about maintenance work on a great ape exhibit, and the maintenance guys leave a screwdriver behind. Well, they let the chimps in. The adult male chimp grabs it and waves it around and yells and uses it to intimidate everybody. Okay, change the scene. It's gorillas. The gorillas walk in. They see the screwdriver lying there. They all smell it carefully, look at it, and then they go on about their business. Change it to orangutans. The orangutans come in, ignore it. Somehow it's ended up covered up with straw, so you can't even see it anymore. That night they break out.
I like that story. There's a lot of stories like that, and I'm sorry that they're apocryphal, because I really would love to have a thing like that actually happen.
Orangs are notorious for taking their exhibits apart.
Is that right?
They're very persistent. They're very skillful. Their fingers are strong.
Mm-hmm. I know we play so much with the chimps because of their closeness to us genetically, but I think orangs are. They're kind of second-class citizens in the primate world.
I mean, for
research.
But there are some good field studies going on. Of course, doing a field study on any of the great apes now is something that's going out is an issue because the populations are crashing.
I want to ask you one more thing about Damri the elephant before mm-hmm. we close. Now, she's a former circus elephant.
Yes.
She has a habit that she does. Tell us about, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about. And I actually saw this with one of the older elephants at Oregon Zoo when I worked there. This Damri does what the elephant I knew did, which is to stand with kind of her back to you and one leg stuck out kind of close to the bars and rock and just rock. And that's what she used to do in the circus when she was chained by that leg, would be just to tug on the chain and rock back and forth. And Damri does that in captivity without any chain.
It's a habit.
In this case, you know, she does it when she's nervous.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that baby elephants rock back and forth. Is that
always rock. Elephants are never still. Uh-huh. You know, you will never see a motionless elephant for more than a minute if it's sound asleep.
That sounds like a truism. You'll never see a motionless elephant.
I think it's pretty close to true.
Let's see now. We have a minute left, do we? As I was reading this book, the thing that I felt about this is that there's an affection in this book among people and among animals and people for their animals. Do you miss that, not being in the zoo anymore?
Well, I miss the animal contact. I miss the best parts of the zoo for sure, and it's wonderful to go back and paint that portrait of the parts that I liked best. That's why I write these books. It's because I want to, so I can go back in
my
head.
So you go back to that. Yes or no, pets? Do you have pets?
We have a hairy little dog.
A hairy little dog.
Yes.
Okay, well... This is the title of this book is Did Not Survive. Anne Littlewood is the author. It's published by Poison Pen Press. I anticipate your next book. Come back and talk to us.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks so much.